From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we take a close look at the case of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist who disappeared in the consulate in Istanbul last week. We're looking specifically at a piece by Assad Abu Khalil posted at consortiumnews.com. We discuss the piece with the editor-in-chief of consortiumnews.com, Joe Loria. Joe, you lived in the Middle East and covered the Middle East from here and from there for a number of media outlets, so you kind of know the lay of the land better than most people that have something to say about it, a lot more than most people. What did you think of Khashoggi as a journalist or as a writer?
I mean, I'm going to admit to your audience right now, I never heard of the guy before. I mean, I don't read the Washington Post op-ed page as a regular thing. I don't know how often you wrote there.
Right.
He's apparently quite well known in Saudi Arabia, and he was well known amongst his colleagues in the Western media. And this is a big part of the story. I don't even think Assad mentions this, but implicit in this story is what The Onion pointed out, a headline that said Saudi Arabia tells Trump to go. Trump tells Saudi Arabia to go back to randomly killing innocent Yemenis rather than picking off one
right.
Saudi journalist.
Right.
In other words, where was the outcry in the Western media?
Yeah.
Where has the outcry been over Yemen?
Yeah, and not just Trump. Yemen has been going on since February of 2017. No, I mean, sorry, 2015, 2014 or 2015.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about that before we begin on our side's piece, because there was a tweet the other day from Samantha Power, who I covered very closely at the UN and knew, and she said it's about time, you know, that we do something about Yemen because Trump can't get away with this. It's the most unbelievable hypocritical thing, because it was her president, who she loved so much. She told a small group of journalists when she first came in how much she loved Barack Obama. He's right. The one who allowed that to happen. It was his war that Trump just took over and should have ended, but he didn't. So he could be blamed for that. But he didn't start this war. The idea of cutting Obama out of this was so extraordinary that it just was a great example of this Trump derangement syndrome and the partisanship here.
Right.
To try to blame Trump 100% for the Yemen war when it was Obama's war. And why I think Obama allowed the war to begin was because it happened during the negotiations over the nuclear deal with the five permanent members of the Security Council, Germany and Iran. And the Saudis were, as the Israelis, were raising hell at that point. They did not want this deal. And they're very pleased that Trump has ended it, at least America's participation in it anyway, not the deal. And I think that Obama said, well, let them blow off some steam in Yemen and that will divert them. And he got his deal through. And of course, the U.S. has been actively participating in this war and giving logistical support. In other words, picking out bombing targets, refueling their planes,
right.
Of course, selling them the munitions, maybe training the pilots, etc. So the U.S., while not directly militarily involved, is playing a huge role there. That's not finally starting to come out because these children on that bus a few months ago were killed. Even though there had been a wedding party that was killed, that killed a couple of hundred people, there have been numerous atrocities, including banning the humanitarian aid from entering ports. But it was the killing of those kids and now the killing of these journals. This is the way the media works. It needs some kind of one event that everybody in the world can understand. Killing of kids on a bus, and now the killing of a journalist. And this is mostly being driven by journalists and
right.
members of Congress. But right. we have to also look at this as a unique opportunity where the barbaric Saudi regime, one of the most barbaric, if not the most, in the entire world, which is such a close ally ever since Franklin Roosevelt met with King in Egypt. I'm trying to think exact waterway there before they where they have the Suez Canal. They met there. That's when they made this deal. That is still pretty much what operates between U.S. and Saudi Arabia, which is a two-way street. We send
right.
weapons their way. They send oil, sold
right.
in dollars, of course,
right.
our way. And we get to pretty much determine oil policy by putting pressure on them.
Right.
So this has been this horrible relationship. Guns for oil. And now we've known for decades, anyone who knows the slightest thing about Saudi Arabia knows, as far as human rights abuses goes, Saudi Arabia has no peer in the world. And there are many horrible regimes around the world. So the U.S. has always said, well, we talk to them privately about that. We put pressure on them. And it's always been, but we discuss the human, because it comes up from time to time in the State Department briefing or to a president in a press conference. We are discussing with our Saudi allies these problems. We're very concerned about heads being chopped off, about women being treated like chattel, etc. But, you know, they're our allies. So now for the first time, we've got a situation where the entire Western media and a good number of Congress actually talking about sanctions. They've invoked the Magnitsky Act against Saudi Arabia.
Magnitsky. Let me, before we get there, just as part of the same setup, the same context. First of all, if we start even just from the so-called Arab Spring in 2011, the Saudis occupied Bahrain, which it's an adjoining country on the Persian Gulf, and it had had a legitimate, actual indigenous democratic uprising by the people there against the government, which is a comprador government to the extent that they have the largest U.S. naval base in the area in Bahrain. It takes up like 60% of their real estate or some ridiculous number like that. Peaceful uprising. And the Saudis went in and suppressed that. That's the the first out of a series of these. And the situation in Yemen reached a degree when the Saudis, beginning with when the Saudis came in March of 2015, it reached a degree that something like half the population was food and water insecure within 6 months of the beginning of the bombing campaign. So in other words, since late 2015, something like 9 million people were at or near starvation and or, you know, we have no water levels. That's what we're talking about. And that has been going on since. And just one last piece of information from the military side. The bombing campaigns, the U.S. equipment that they're using require AWACS to help them target. And the AWACS are only piloted by Americans and NATO troops. So the U.S. has actually been actively involved in the bombing campaign in terms of providing targeting and such since the beginning.
Yeah, the AWACS help target school buses, wedding parties, things
like
that.
Exactly, right.
So two things. On Bahrain, I was in Bahrain the day they lifted military law. There's a causeway that connects Saudi Arabia to Bahrain, which is an island.
Right.
And they came over that causeway. That was an invasion. Of course, they asked the troops to come in, the Bahrainis. So in that sense, it wasn't legally an invasion.
Well, the king did, because there was an uprising against the king.
Yeah,
and so the king said, come rescue me. That's the same thing we have in Yemen, by the way. The guy who claims to be the government actually was termed out and left the country because he was driven out by the Yemenis. And he was in Riyadh when he asked for them to restore him.
Now, the very beginnings of the war on Yemen, I had a very important scoop that was in the Wall Street Journal. And then I wrote a longer, more detailed piece for Middle East Eye. And what this was based on was Jamal Ben Omar. He was the UN envoy at the time to Yemen. He was trying to get, his job was to negotiate a peace arrangement that would end the conflict, which hadn't escalated to the point yet, which would resolve the political differences in Yemen. And he told me that, and this was, he put part of it on the record, and he told me on the record that they were very close to a deal. They had agreed, that the Houthi had agreed to withdraw their forces from Sana'a, the capital, that there would be a coalition government, which they would get 20% of the seats in the parliament guaranteed. Women would get 30% of the troops. And the UN was already starting to train a force to take over as a security force, a local security force that would take over for the Houthi when they withdrew from the capital. The only sticking point was over the presidency. There was either they wanted the Houthi and the other parties wanted just either a strong vice president to counterbalance Hadi, who was the president who had fled to Saudi Arabia. Or to have a three-party president that rotated, something like they had in Yugoslavia, which was more than three, but, you know, that would rotate. And that's where the Hadi and the Saudis are calling the shots for Hadi, disagreed. And Ben Omar, a diplomat, he was off the record, but he told me that he believed that the Saudis started bombing because they were very close to this deal and they needed to stop it. They could not have this type of situation of democracy in Yemen. It came down to, as you say, the Arab Spring. The last thing a monarchy like Saudi Arabia or all the other Gulf monarchies want is the success of democracy in the region, because they would be threatened by that, but their own people would want the same, and they cannot tolerate that. They want to dominate the region, of course, for their own power, but they certainly don't want Yemen, the country they've always controlled who the leader is since the beginning, or have tried to anyway, to have on their southern border a democratic solution, a real parliament, women in the parliament. No. So they bombed to start that war then. Now, he told me this. He was leaving. He was about to give his last briefing to the UN Security Council. My story came out the morning of that briefing. And a lot of my colleagues asked the ambassadors coming in, including Yuli Vorontsov, who died. Was it Yuli Vorontsov? What was his name? Churkin. Vitaly Churkin,
yes.
Yeah. Vitaly Churkin was the ambassador of Russia at the time, and my colleagues asked him, is this story in the Wall Street Journal true? He said, absolutely not, it's nonsense. And then they come out of the conference, and Churkin said, that was true. It's exactly what Benamar told me he briefed at the council. Whoa. So I got the briefing before the UN Security Council did and had it in the journal. And that story stays with me, and a lot of Yemeni activists keep putting that on Twitter, because it shows the origin of this terrible war that has all been Mohammed bin Salman's war. He was the defense secretary at the time. He was the de facto king, even before he became the crown prince, or as people call him, the clown prince. And he is he's a absolute, you know, perfect symbol of what a spoiled brat Saudi monster is in this in that region. He has this war is way worse than anything he did, including killing this journalist. And now we can get to, and nobody's talking about, they're starting to, as I said, but he got away with this for years, from Obama into the early days of Trump. Now, to go back to Asad Abdul Khalil, the Angry Arabs piece that he wrote for us at Consortium News, he revealed who's the real Jamal Khashoggi. Now, Jamal Khashoggi was not who was being portrayed in the Western media as this great investigative journalist who really stood up to the regime. He was a creature of the regime. Right. And the entire history of the guy's career is in this piece. And basically, he had to go shopping for the right prince. And he had several princes who were his backers or rabbis, as we would say here, but certainly not in Saudi Arabia. Right. And that, the base, Turki Al-Faisal, who was the longtime head of the Saudi intelligence, was one of his major backers, as well as Faisal's brother, Khalid Al-Faisal, who owned Al-Watan newspaper, a Saudi newspaper, which Al-Watan means the motherland. That's the name of the paper. And Khashoggi was the editor there. But he never got in trouble for anything he wrote.
He was also at Al Arabiya.
He wrote for Al Arabiya.
No, he was editor-in-chief, and he also was like a senior official. I forget what the hell it was, but yeah. I mean, he was hot stuff there, too. And I remember Al Arabiya, okay, the line that they took on Bahrain, obviously, Libya, and Syria. And so people that are, you know, on the left particularly, that are lionizing this guy, he was in favor of everything that happened in Libya and everything that happened in Syria.
And Afghanistan, he played.
And Afghanistan, yep.
He went there and was side by side with bin Laden. He was with Faisal, Turki Al-Faisal.
That's right.
Was running that war as his head of Saudi intelligence, backing groups, jihadist groups, one of which later established itself as Al-Qaeda, as we know. There were others, not just bin Laden, but he was an important one, obviously. And that our great national security advisor, Brzezinski, was closely aligned with as well during that Afghan war. But Khashoggi was there in Afghanistan. And as Assad points out in our piece, that the Western media is portraying him, including Mr. David Ignatius, who, if there's any CIA asset in the media, it's got to be him.
Right. Yeah, right.
He wrote that, you know, this guy was an embedded reporter, like doing independent reporting, as if bin Laden was going to let some independent journalist come and report on what's really going on. He was part of the PR operation there. And to back these horrible jihadists. So Khashoggi has been part and parcel of everything that's wrong with Saudi Arabia until now. This is the point, until he died. He was not really a critic of Mohammed bin Salman. He got a little mildly upset in one piece in the Washington Post, which I linked to here, and that people could read, which he was upset that some of his friends, including his last prince, was he, a lot of princes started deserting him. Why? Because he went to the U.S.
Right.
And he was a defector. And this is the reason why Assad believes that he was murdered, is because they don't tolerate defection. And he brings up a point of a defector from back in the 1960s who was offed by the Saudis in an embassy in Beirut, I believe. But same system. The guy defected to Beirut and he was killed in the embassy. So if you start in the mildly criticizing Mohammed bin Salman for those arrests, if you readers remember, Mohammed bin Salman, when he became crown prince, one of the first things, if not the first thing he did, was to put like 30, a huge number of these princes under house arrest in the Ritz-Carlton, a luxury five-star hotel. They couldn't leave for a while. He shook them down and tried, defang them and take money from them and then let them go. But so he started losing. He lost his last prince who was backing him. So he mildly criticized him in the post. But Assad is arguing that wasn't the reason why he was killed, but that it was simply a defector and that he could not show that anyone would want to even defect and live in the United States. There are some people who believe it was a CIA asset. It's right. Quite possible. I don't know that. But
let me just, on that point,
yeah. Yes.
Because I don't know if you noticed the timing, but the same day that he, quote-unquote, disappeared, the same day he walked into the embassy, as we've seen on video, was the day that Trump said Saudi Arabia and its king wouldn't last 2 weeks in power without American military support. October 2nd, both events.
That's very interesting.
Yes, it
I did not know that. Good work, Don.
Thank you.
Oh, that was one of the truest things Trump ever said, by the way.
I know, which is if you think of the political dynamics here, okay, on the one, you've got the whole media and the U.S. intel, you can see in the Congress and everything too, everybody chirping up about, how suddenly the Saudis are evil for doing this. They haven't had a thing to say with all the things you've listed already. And now they're chirping, and the only champion that they have is Trump. And 2 weeks ago, he said they wouldn't last 2 weeks.
Well, it could be a coincidence, but who knows? They're not going to get away with this story. My feeling about how this is going to end is they're going to paper it over somehow. There's too much money at stake.
Right.
Yeah, they're going to boycott this investment meeting. They're going to make a lot of noise. There might be a resolution against this in Congress. There could even be some cosmetic sanctions or something. And it'll take a while for this to die down. I doubt MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, will step down as crown prince. That might happen as the cost of going back to normalcy, which is the long-term relationship that they outlined between U.S. and Saudi Arabia and other countries. Britain has a big role over there, too. Obviously, they created the Saudi regime.
Right.
So from this Wahhabist sect.
I mean, it's
so
deeply buried in our institution. I mean, not for nothing. Just about every member of Congress is, they talk about AIPAC and the influence that AIPAC has, and it does in Congress. But the Saudis have, equal impact. And they have a weapon that Israel doesn't have, which is that if we want to mess with the incumbents, all we got to do is double the price of oil tomorrow and throw the country into an economic tailspin, and incumbents suddenly have great political liabilities. So
that's a good point.
Aside from paying them off, they've got this the power to meddle, if you will, and they're well aware of that. So
well,
we
I'm
might
glad
see
you brought the Saudi lobby, because it's rarely talked about. The Israeli lobby is, and there was an interesting story. Not that I agree with a lot of its import, but in the Israeli paper Al Haaretz today or yesterday, in which the title was Why Isn't There a BDS for Saudi Arabia? So I would think there should be a boycott and investment sanctions against Saudi Arabia. But of course, the piece was, why are they just targeting Israel and not that? But I think there should be BDS for both Israel and Saudi Arabia. But these are obviously America's two absolute main allies in the region. They both of their policies are detrimental to so many millions of people in the region. And but it benefits the United States, and they're not acting as a broker. You know, what's funny is that the Saudis threatened all these things. In their typical way, they're not very subtle. They said, if there's sanctions against us, we're going to do huge damage, on oil prices and other things. And we could even become allies with Iran.
Right.
Can you discuss that? I'm going to turn this interview around and ask you a question.
Go ahead.
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, you have to look at it in multiple dimensions, really. First, just to outline for people, folks may know the fundamental facts, but not really understand the dynamics. you know, Saudi, you said the Brits created Saudi Arabia. That's a, was known as Arabia. The Saud is actually
right.
like a family. And
name
so
family.
It's
right.
saying Saudi Arabia is like saying Rockefeller's America or something.
Exactly.
Okay.
Rockefeller
so,
America. It should be called that, actually. So, it should have been in the nightly anyway,
yeah.
at one point in our history. But go on.
You know? So, so you're starting with that, which means, in other words, it's an agent of you know, European and American imperialism. It's that's its function. You know, the state apparatus there is a comprador, you know, a colonial apparatus, a neo-colonial apparatus. You can be technical about the form, but the essence of it, the substance is
exactly.
Yeah. Now, so you've got that, and Iran is a country that threw off its imperial government back in 1979. Right. And this is, you know, the people of Iran and native elites in Iran asserting their own interests on their own behalf on the international stage. So that's an entirely different, you know, position. It is
and
an opposition.
Shia, and there's Shia, which is a huge part of it, too.
Now you have also, you know, a schism, to use the word of the day, in Islam. Using it in the sense that it's being used with respect to the Orthodox Church right now, which is an interesting condition that's happening now. But you have, you know, like a cultural difference over this particular branch of Islam. You also have a an ethnic difference, although it may not be apparent to, you know, Europeans or white folks, quote unquote. But you know, they're the Iranians are not Arabs. The Iranians are Persians. And so you have that those differences at the basis. You have one camp that tends, based on the Arab ethnicity and a Sunni, you know, religious doctrine, to orbit around Saudi Arabia, and they also have tended to be part of the imperial construct. So, you know, you have all these different ties. For the threat to ally with Iran to be really credible, what you're talking about is changing camps, not just changing camps like you would quit the Jets and, you know, join the Giants. You're talking about in the midst of a war, going from one side to the other and announcing in advance while you're still in the camp of, you know, your present master, telling your master, I'm leaving and deserting to the other side. That's the power relations between Europe and Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia has that oil weapon. But, you know, the way the U.S. talks about we can't have Chinese electronics in our weapons systems because they might flick a switch. Well, who knows what switches are in the stuff that the Saudis have bought from us over the years. And we know that they can't fly the planes without our active assistance. So,
well, as you remember, Henry Kissinger came out, had, you know, talked openly about plans to invade Saudi Arabia. So the U.S.
Right.
could always take out the Saudis in 2 weeks, as
right.
somebody
That's right.
said recently.
That's right.
so they got to be careful with that. But would Iran agree with that? They're the other side of that story. So
That's
that
correct.
Was a kind of hollow threat. However, I have been maintaining for a long time now, and I lived 3 years in the Middle East, and I have really – and I went to every country in the Middle East except Yemen and Iran, and I went to Saudi Arabia as well. I could tell you that – a rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia is the only solution for all the crises, from Beirut,
right.
from Lebanon to Iraq to Yemen to even extending into Afghanistan. The Saudis, those are the two main powers, and they have their proxy forces fighting one another throughout the region. And the United States, if they were real statesmen, if they're acting like a neutral statesman and wanted peace and some kind of prosperity, as they'd say that they want to bring to the Middle East, they would work hard as a neutral arbiter, as they don't do in the Middle East between the Palestinians and the Israelis. They
like
would do
Korea.
Between the Saudis and the Iranians, so that they would somehow work together and stop their war and die down, you know, this rivalry, which they use the Shia-Sunni split as an ideological weapon, but
right.
it's really about politics and power,
right.
and that kind of thing, not really a religious dispute.
Right.
Although on the local level, I have to tell you, many, many, many people I met, and throughout the Middle East, there are Sunnis, the average Sunni doesn't hate or doesn't respect Shia, so it's filtered down
right.
into a real belief on the ground. It's worked. That's right. What the idea of the ideology is.
But in Iraq, for example, up until 2003 or maybe 99, I don't know, but that really got massaged by the Americans. And from what I understood, I've never been there. I know you've traveled extensively there and you spent a lot of time there. But my understanding was, you know, you had people, you know, Shia families that married into, you know, Sunni families.
Why was that, Don? Because it was a secular ruler there.
Right, exactly. Right.
But it was a nationalist secular ruler, right. Like in Libya, like in Syria. And that's what the Saudis and the Americans and the Israelis want to get rid of.
Right.
And they've used religious extremists to do that.
Right.
Repeatedly. Including in Afghanistan, there was a secular democratic, well, not about democratic, but certainly a secular ruler where women had a lot more rights than under the Saudis.
You had a communist government in Kabul.
Just like with Assad. Yep. Just like with Assad. These are police states. We can criticize them. Saddam was the most brutal of them all.
Right.
But these were secular regimes that stood up to the U.S. once in a while. They made alliances with the U.S. too from time to time, like Saddam with the U.S. against Iran in the Iran-Iraq War in the 80s. And even Assad made a deal with the U.S. To do rendition flights, if you remember, right?
Yeah, I mean, you're going back even further. I mean, these originally came into being sponsored often, particularly in Iraq. I mean, Saddam and some of the others in the Baathist party there and the other Baathist parties, they were sponsored by the U.S. If you go back to, say, Nasser's time, for example.
The communists they were.
Yeah, you had communist movements in these countries and a strong tendency towards that. You have to go back to the context of the real Cold War at that time. And you had, and so these people were offering, hey, you know what? We don't have to be, screw Russia and China. We're not involved with that. But hey, you can have health care. Yes, you can have housing. Yes, you can, you know, the way we used to have public housing in the United States. When there's pressure from communists and socialists, these guys can come across once in a while with some stuff for the people. But once that threat was gone, I mean, it was almost simultaneous with Iraq. That happened in 1990. The summer of 1990 was when the big invasion of Kuwait took place and they started moving troops over there. And so that's exactly,
the end of the Cold War. Soviet Union was gone, and the neoliberal project took off in the West.
That's right.
And in the Middle East, they were able to go after the remaining clients, so-called, of the Soviets, now the Russians, who were secular rulers, and they had to be removed.
Let's get
and
them
this
out.
Has
right.
been a disaster for the region.
Right. That's exactly
without
right.
question. It's a neocon-driven project was to take over to bring back in Iran, for example, a puppet leader that they had with the Shah. So
that's
that
right.
was in the U.S. camp at that time. So the U.S. is not interested in brokering peace between Iran and Saudi Arabia,
right.
which would solve so many problems in the region. They are totally on the side of the Saudis, and they will remain so despite this public relations disaster, a nightmare for the Saudis, in particular Mohammed bin Salman. But I think they're going to die it down. They're going to try this is going to be a little more difficult than the usual Saudi way to get out of a tight spot, which is to pay everybody off. They are going to pay everybody off. They're probably paying off big time Erdogan in Turkey, who blew blew the cover on this story, right?
Yeah.
And he did that on purpose, I think, to get the Saudis to stop paying up and
get a check.
Big time.
Yep. Hey, the same with, the whole Congress and who knows who else, I mean, these media companies here even, because the Saudis spend a lot of money on those public service messages about, come to Saudi Arabia. We have gorgeous city Riyadh, blah, vacation hotspot, all that nonsense, the Department of Tourism. They buy a lot of time on CNN and, other media buys here.
Yes. And the other thing that Khashoggi was, by the way, was was sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood. And this has become the number one enemy of the Gulf regimes.
Right. That's right.
In Saudi Arabia, they were a huge force in the 1950s in particular, as Assad points out.
Right.
They ran the educational system of the whole country. So they grew up a generation sympathetic and praising the Muslim Brothers. But suddenly, as Assad said after 9/11, they needed a scapegoat for the Islamists that they were actually backing. And in UAE in particular, the Muslim Brotherhood became active in opposition. Yeah. So in Qatar as well. So the Muslim Brotherhood has become a real enemy of the Saudis. And when they won the election in Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, was the Saudis that opened up the checkbook again to back al-Sisi and the military and have been bankrolling the government ever since.
Yep.
They want to keep the Muslim Brothers out of power. It was their operation.
then we got to stop there. Maybe we could pick it up next week. We were wondering if we'd have enough to say about this. There's plenty to say about this case.
I know. I have 100 things more, but wait. We'll
you got it. Joe, thank you very much. Great talking with you guys.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.